No, it's not Doctor Who, it's Dr. Carl. I just like that piece of music. It's a different version of the original TV theme, and I just like it. So it's stuck with Dr. Carl. Doc, we'll have to come up with something new if you're not happy with that. Have you thought of this?
I do like Doctor Who. I remember hearing it way back then, and I still love it now.
All right, well, that's your music until we come up with something better. Dr. Carl Krusznicki, it's my one of my favourite times of the week when we talk science, and we learn something along the way. I think we usually do. Dr. Carl, there was a very sad story in the news recently about a Texan man, and he'd spent most of his 78 years in an iron lung chamber. And a lot of our new listeners, our younger listeners, may not know or have heard of polio. When I went to primary school, 1969, I remember the year, it was the year man walked on the moon, and I arrived at Elanora Heights Primary School. There were two kids in our year in calipers, and it's not that long ago. I wonder how many people understand what polio was, and the fact that you can still get it, and I know you have a story about that, but getting back to this Texan man who spent most of his life in an iron lung chamber, what a wretched existence he must have had. What are your thoughts, Dr. Carl? And can you explain for our listeners what an iron lung was, or still is?
Well, firstly, with regard to the wretched thing, when I was a doctor in the kids' hospital, I noticed that the people with the diseases don't mind too much. So the kids who were going to die, they were cool with it. It was the parents who were really upset.
Sure, right.
And then when you've got adults who have some sort of injury, they adjust to it and they keep on living because the option of not living is worse, and so they keep on living. So on one hand, it's wretched to the outsider, but if you've been paralyzed from the neck down and now you can move around, or say from the nipples down, but you can still use your arms, well, mate, for you it's terrific. You can still use your arms. And so the same with the iron lung. And the way it works is normally you contract your diaphragm muscle, which is curved. It goes straight. So when you contract it, it goes straight. It pulls your lungs down. It makes them bigger. If your mouth is open, in comes air. So that's all been paralyzed. So then you put a box around somebody at their neck and their trunk, and then you seal it, and then you have a pump that goes push, pull, moving air in and out. And the first one goes way back to 1670.
No.
And then, yeah, that was thinking about the idea of using that to help people breathe. Actually built around 1830. And in the early, in the late 1800s, they began using them for people who'd been poisoned from coal gas working in a coal mine. And what happens is you get carbon monoxide. Carbon monoxide, as opposed to dioxide, carbon monoxide jumps onto your hemoglobin 500 times better than oxygen, and it stays there longer. So if you can just get them through the next couple of hours, then eventually the carbon monoxide will come off and they'll come back to life. But they didn't think they'd be using it for long term. And that happened around 1928 or so. The so-called drinker, as in drinking alcohol, respirator, invented by Philip Drinker. And it was just a box powered by a pump. And people were kept in there for days or weeks, or as you mentioned, years or their entire life.
It's unbelievable to think of, folks. And if you don't know what we're talking about, Google iron lung, and also Google polio and the polio vaccination that changed the world. Dr. Carl, when some poor wretched person is in a coma, either because of an accident or an induced coma, medically induced coma, they're on a life support system, but it doesn't look like an iron lung. So are these people in comas able to breathe still on their own or not?
They can. There's a book called The Reptile Brain by Carl Sagan. And so right at the very front, you've got the forebrain. You know how we've got a forehead that goes up, whereas the chimpanzees have got a forehead that goes back? We've got a thing called a forebrain. And that leads us to deal with all of the things that make us human, like poetry, income tax, and weapons of mass destruction. And then after that, We have a motor and sensory thing, so you can move your arms, you can look at the world, you can hear the world, and right at the back you've got vision, and then coming down, you've got a brain stem. And in there, you have automatic, I guess, pacemakers or clocks that just do your breathing for you. So you can be in a coma, and still, that area down there is still running, the so-called reptilian brain, the basic brain, and that'll keep you going.
Because when you hear of people who are in an induced coma, for example, and they're on life support, and the families have to gather around and make a decision, do we stop this now? Is it all over? It doesn't look like an iron lung. And so that's what I was wondering.
Oh, okay. Depending on how high the injury is, either they can breathe for themselves or not. And now we have a somewhat invasive system, where you go into the airway, which is maybe the diameter of your thumb, and you go in there with a skinny pipe, that's the diameter of a match. So being a match, it's much smaller in diameter than your thumb, and there's a balloon around it. And you pump that balloon up, and suddenly goes squash and expands, and it wedges itself in the airway, and then you pump air in and out and in and out, but you're pressing some rubber up against the delicate mucous membrane. And you can do that for a minute. But for a month? No. So you can't do it long term. You've got to keep on shifting it around. And it gets really messy. And it is really hard in that circumstance.
I'm with you. And that's another topic for another day. But people often ask the question, why is there such a long waiting list for major organ transplants? And I try to explain, it was explained to me that major organs need a blood supply. And so often it's somebody who is on life support, and the families say, let's turn this off and let's donate their organs. So that's why there's such a long wait, and it's so rare to get a match, because these large organs need a blood supply right to the very end, don't they?
Yeah, and it's hard when you're dealing with somebody who's about to die.
Oh, yeah.
To say to them. And when I was a medical doctor, I had to do this a few times. And I was specifically asked, because we knew this person had a type of blood type immunomatch, and there was somebody else in the world just waiting for their organ. And if they got that organ, they would live. And so you knew that maybe in Wollongong or New Jersey or in Johannesburg, there was one person who was going to die if they didn't get that organ and would probably live if they did. And then you go to the family and say, look, I'm sorry to bring it up, and you try to do it delicately. And the universal response was, we won't do it because they've suffered enough. And they have suffered enough, but they're not going to suffer anymore by giving up their organ. But in the moment, it's really hard. So what I've done is I've just simply ticked everything and signed away all my rights to all my body parts so that they can be used for somebody else after I die, to make it easier when I'm dead.
Dr. Carl Krusinicki is with us. Dr. Carl, the topic of organ donations, you can have it on your license, or you can make it really clear that you are happy to be an organ donor. But do you think it should be changed? Do you think it should be automatic that everybody is a donor and you go to the trouble to opt out? If you feel strongly against it, then that's fine, but opt out. At the moment, you have to opt in. Your thoughts?
It's so hard. Like, for example, if you've got a car that's less than 10 years old, you have automatically opted in that all of your driving information, how hard you accelerate and brake and how often, and how hard you turn the steering wheel and how often, all of that goes back to the car company, who then sells it to a data broker like LexisNexis, LexisNexis, who then sells it to the insurance company, who says, mate, that Luke Bono at 4 o'clock in the morning or 7 o'clock on the way home, mate, he accelerated really hard. We're going to increase his insurance by 20%. And you opted in without wanting to when you bought the car, because you signed a bit of paper that says, I accept this car, and buried in there is that you give them
my driving
the right
history.
But to sell that, they can make money out of selling that history to somebody else, who then sells it to the insurance company. So on one hand, I'm sort of against this automatic stuff. But on the other hand, when you're with a patient and they die because there's an organ somewhere that the family were just too upset in the heat of the moment to pass along. Like if it was a week later or a month later, they'd say, of course, he doesn't need it. He's going to die. It'll just go in the ground, get eaten by the worms. But in the heat of the moment, they find it hard. And I fully sympathize. It's hard. I don't know. Help me, Luke. Help me. I don't know.
What we'll do is we'll let our listeners help us on 1-3-3-5-3, and I'll let you know what people have to say. Dr. Carl, it's always, always fascinating to talk to you. Thank you so much. Enjoy the rest of your day. And we will catch up and we'll learn something again next week, eh?
Ah, we will laugh and learn. Hopefully we'll have a funny topic next week.